Hey everyone, welcome to this episode of the Sport Kite Podcast. I'm your host, Nick O'Neill, and I want to thank you for tuning in and listening. In this episode, I sit down with Carl Robertshaw, who previously gave a talk at the Sport Kite Camp that we had at the Washington State International Kite Festival. Carl shares with us a little bit more of what he did after Sport Kite Camp, what other festivals are able to bring to the table, and we also talk more about the history of the high-level sport kite team that he was a member and founder of, Team Aircraft, and about the training it took to hone the craft of high-level sport kite competition and performance. We also kind of touch base a little bit on who continues to inspire him and how music gets used to help tell the story. This is the first part of a several episode interview that we're going to release. And I just want to put a little caveat out there that I had a little bit of a mix up and forgot to hit the record button at the start of the interview. So we reset and we tried to touch base again and get moving forward. So you may hear references to that in the first part of the episode. If you like what you hear here, consider going to buymeacoffee.com/sportkite and chipping in a few bucks. Every little bit really does help. We also would love to get your feedback on what kind of episodes you're enjoying hearing. Do you want more interviews? You want more tech talk? You want more panels? You want more reviews? What do you want? We do have quite a bit more that is lined up to be released in the next season, and that'll be a lot more tech talk and a lot more panel stuff. But now is the time to let us know what you would like to hear. We're kind of trying to spread the load, get as much information as we can here on the Sport Kite Podcast. So with that, I should say that if you want to share your feedbacks, your thoughts, your concerns, your questions, you can always email me at info@sportkite.org. All right, so let's try this again. With that, let's go ahead and jump into this episode.
No, on a writing course as well. So,
Here we go. Now I've got it grayed out.
Yeah, there's a red dot that's come up. So
okay, perfect, perfect. So sorry about that. All right, so thankfully I took notes so I can drop us back into some of that again.
Brilliant, good.
So I'll go ahead and get started again.
Hello again.
Hi, long time no see. Right now, I'm on a chat with Carl Robertshaw, who thankfully came and joined us at the Washington State International Kite Festival at our little mini sport kite camp we did, and he gave a talk there. We did this little fireside chat. You kind of talked about your experience and your approach to just all around kite flying, let alone team and art and just kind of everything, and definitely well received. Everybody there absolutely loved it. And yeah, so care to share more about that experience and then what you did right after that?
Brilliant. Yes. Yeah. Gosh, I'm trying to think, because this is take two. I'm trying to think what I said before.
You said you went to another kite festival.
Yes. Right, I went to Kites Over Lake Michigan straight after Wiskiff, which is great. And so really, yeah, good to do two festivals and quite different ones, which is lovely. And yeah, it's a really good thing to connect with old friends I've known for a very long time, for 30 odd years through kiting, and new friends, and yeah, just meet new people and kind of get the kind of experience of both Wiskiff, and I've been to that beach, that's my fourth time, so I've competed there at World Cup, I've been to the there's a competition there, I can't remember what it's called, anyway, and then do Kites Over Lake Michigan, which is a lovely, smaller festival, very sort of intimate. Nice to have a festival as well that's, you know, to go to a smaller festival that's got high expectations, but less agenda, as it were, which is really nice. So yeah, it reminded me a little bit of Chervia in that sense. Chervia is more of an arts festival, but this was, you know, like a good social event as well. I mean, you know, they're all good social events, but this is there's another take on it, which is great. So it's really good to catch up with people there as well. So yeah, it's good to travel. And yeah, and the fireside talk thing was brilliant. I thought that was so fantastic what you did, and it was really good to hear everybody else talk as well. And I learned a lot from it, and to pick up and be reminded of things, you know, that you sort of take for granted, or you hadn't thought about, or just, you know, different ways of other people going about the same thing, and kind of there's a different take on it, which is really great and very reassuring. Lots to be learned, you know, and you never stop learning, do you? So you never know it all. And yeah, that was brilliant. Thank you.
Well, thank you for coming. I really, really did appreciate it. You know, it was just like perfectly fortuitous that we had, you know, the handful of you guys want to share what you're doing. So yeah, for me, I know afterwards, one of the things I got a lot of comments or messages about was team flying. They were inspired by both you and Michelle to get out and do more team flying. And sure. God knows we need that. We definitely need that. So yeah. Well,
that was brilliant. That was, because obviously I've done it for a long time and done it at a high level. And I love team flying at whatever level it is, you know, flying with friends, just, you know, kind of low key, or whether it's, you know, practicing, just being out on a beach by yourself or in a field, you know, as a team, sort of, you know, you're not in team gears, nobody's watching, you know, there might be a dog walker go past and stuff like that. That's cool as well. And what was really nice about the fireside talk was, as Michael was talking, he's talking about team flying and so on, it's going into my head, team flying, what, because most people think of team flying at this point in time as quadline flying. So, you know, but there's two different sort of team flying landscapes, you could say. So the quadline flying, it's easy to, as a common language around all the fields, as it were, where you can slot in, you can join a group of people and you can fly together, and there's a kind of safety net, as it were, with quadline flying, where you can stop and you can, or you can go slower, and you can talk through what you're doing as you're doing it, and you can make a shape and you can just hold it there, hold it steady. And as Michael was talking, I was thinking, yeah, what is it? What's the thing that he's talking about? Because he's sort of not taking it for granted, but sort of there's an assumption here that the two things are the same. If you're thinking of quadline flying, he's not talking about that. He's talking about dual line flying, which is a different thing, in a different experience, because the kites are moving all the time. You can't stop. There's no safety. There's no way of so I asked him, you know, what is it about it, and he got to it. It's the thrill, it's the adrenaline, because these things are moving quickly and they're not stopping. So you do need the kind of pre-planning of the maneuvers, which you talked about, and having the kites the same and the same line lengths and so on. So there is a bit of organization that needs to be had, but what do you get from it? And it's exhilarating. It's this thing of where you're on a roller coaster and you can't get off, and you've got to keep moving, you've got to keep going with it. And that's the thrill, I think, that you get, which you don't get from quadline. So from dual line, it's a different animal and a different thing that you come away with. And what we certainly did with Whiskiff was come away with that feeling, and flying with John and Paul and Michael and the others and so on, just briefly, we just had a kind of impromptu fly and went through some basic maneuvers. And I've done this a lot in the past, sort of know how to stand at number one position. I don't like, that's not my favorite position, but to take a sort of group of people who have a good idea of what they're doing and take them through these maneuvers in quite a quick pace, as it were. So you're getting that adrenaline rush. And that's the thing, I think, for me personally, I'd rather chase that adrenaline rush than standing in a field with kites sort of moving or static flying, as it were, and not moving very fast. And you can fly quad lines fast, you know, so that's, you know, I'm talking about the dual line thing being a thrill that you don't get, as it were. That's the thing you have with the kind of organized team flying that is dual line that you can't get from quad line flying yet. I say yet.
Yeah, I think you were referring to it as a big roller coaster and like a total thrill ride. Yeah.
So how do you do that? Yeah. So that's the thing. And as we said before, like kites are the second oldest toy in the world, recorded toy in the world, and the doll is the oldest. So humans won't be without kites. You know, that we will always have kites. And the thing that we've seen is a kind of rise and a kind of, yeah, maybe a mellowing down of kind of who's around and who's doing what, you know, and kind of it's not the kind of heyday of the 90s, which is, you know, you've got, you know, you're competing against 17 teams in Europe and stuff. And then, you know, the World Championships is 14 teams and the kind of top 10 are strong, you know, and the top five are going to be bidding for the top spot sort of thing. It's not that kind of landscape at the moment. And never say never, you know, sort of it's not dead and gone. It's sort of, it might change and shift, and these things do, you know, might morph into something else. Kite festivals are certainly doing that. And the thrill doesn't go away. That adrenaline doesn't go away. So to get jump on the line and to do that impromptu fly that we did in Wiscliffe was awesome, because it was a real reminder and a spotlight on what it feels like. And we're all chasing that feeling. That's why we do what we do, because we're emotionally connected to these, you know, to what it feels like to have a piece of string on a bit of fabric and some sticks in the sky in whatever form it is. And that's the thing I think that we love. And it's amazing how many people, as soon as you get out of your own, get away from your own patch. So for me to come over to the States, it's really great to be reminded, oh yeah, so-and-so's there, so-and-so's there, so-and-so's there. People are still around. It's just we haven't, in the last few years, we haven't been able to travel, and we haven't actually made those connections like we used to. So I think one of the questions from somebody at one of the talks was, how do I find a team, or how do I find an event? Well, you do it yourself. And that's what we used to do. And there were more people around doing it, but you find another person and you find a pair, or you teach somebody. And team flying is not about skill level in flying kites. It's about how you have a camaraderie and the kind of how you think together, as it were. So you form a kind of tight-knit crew, so to speak. You can call it a family, but it's not quite that. It's more of a crew. Whether it's two people or whether it's four people, whether it's six or seven or eight or however many, you have a common interest, and that common interest brings you together to do this endeavor that is team flying. So I would say, if you're looking to get on a team, you've got to form it yourself. And that's how it will grow, by people doing it, because you can't look for other people to do it for you, because that's not how this kite flying world happens, as it were. It's not given to you on a plate, as it were. It's self-made, in a sense.
Yeah. And there's like
so
much,
long answer.
Yeah, there's so much to digest.
There's a lot there.
I guess it kind of goes in, well, we can go into where we were about to go into first take, when I realized we weren't recording and doing the second take. You were talking about aircraft, so this kind of perfectly goes into the crew, the team, the tribe, right? Because aircraft was you, your brother, and close friends,
yeah,
right? And then, yeah, you were going to speak on aircraft and going to Australia.
Sure. So I was lucky enough to get into university, and then lucky enough to get an exchange to Australia in my first year. And I flew kites for that whole 6 months I was out there, and every day. And on the way there, I stopped with my ticket. It was brilliant. It was so great. And stayed in Hawaii with Robert Luella and Barbara. And sorry, I missed them at WhisKiff, and I hope they're okay. But got to see high performance up close and at close quarters, and that was a real lesson. And then came back via San Diego and got to manage to went out to Japan from Australia, stayed with a friend from college who just happened to live in that village where they were having the world championships in Odawara. So I got to see all the teams, make friends with them there, and got to speak to Ron Rich and Pam Kirk and Mike and Paul from Top of the Line, and they gave me the map of where their secret practice field was in San Diego. So they invited me there. So I like some kind of autograph hunter, eager kid who's 19, sort of just wanting to learn and clean as mustard, basically, went along to their practice ground and got to press the tape, you know. So I was the audience of one with them flying and going through all their routines, and it was awesome. And then at lunchtime got cheeky and I said, can I fly with you, asking Ron Rich, can I fly with him? And he stood up and I said, I mean the team. And so Mike stood out, and so I had Pam Kirk on one side and Ron Rich on the other, and got to go through the maneuvers one by one, bit by bit. And I'm a visual learner, and so the description wouldn't sink in, but would do it once, I'd get it wrong, do it right, and then I get it, do it the second time, and I get it absolutely bang on. And Pam was giggling away, bless her. And it's kind of, is she laughing? Because why is she laughing? Oh, it's because I'm trying very, very hard and succeeding somehow to match them. And that was a huge confidence boost. And I learned a lot, how to refuel, you know, and how to, you know, fly like them, sort of thing. So I came back to the UK, and Jeremy and Nick they'd come out of a team that was kind of doing okay, but they wanted to be really professional. I wanted to be really professional. So we formed a team, and in the second year, James joined, and we were hot shit. not to be too boasty, but we worked out what the Americans were doing, who were dominating the sport, and how to do it at that kind of level, but also do it our way. And it was, how do we up the game, sort of thing. So we did. That's what we worked it out. We would fly twice a week, 8 hours a day.
Oh, wow. a full-time job.
Yeah, we only had Christmas off, you know, so it was 40 hours a week, basically. And we're all, you know, students, all self-employed. And Jeremy had the kite shop, you know, so we were able to do that. And that's what it took to learn, to hone the craft, hone our skills, become experts in our field, so to speak, start to kind of take on the giants of the sport kiting world, like high performance. And you know, we had Top of the Line in our minds, even though they'd retired. We still have so we're visualizing these top teams and flying against them, even though we didn't have them on the field or weren't actually competing against them physically until we got to World Cup. So it's all about visualization in that sense. So we did, and we were never out of the top two in the world in the 5 years that we competed.
Wow. What was a team after high performance that continued to inspire you?
Wow.
Or challenged you?
Challenged. So James and I then went on to be Evolver. So we flew pairs, and we took what we'd learned and we started to work out how to do two kites instead of four and make those two kites fill the sky in the same kind of way and make it sort of intricate and complex. Trying to get to the answer the question. So, after that, then there's Scratch Bunnies, but that's kind of the I'm just trying to rack my brains.
Like right now,
maybe if I answer a different question that you haven't asked, but okay. So for me, I think the top of the line precision from Japan 92 is probably the best precision ever. And if you want a lesson in how to be precise, how to fly precision, that's the routine always. That's the one that I'll always refer to, and I'll refer other people to, because if you look at the kites, they're not, when they stall, that I flew those kites, so I know how nose forward they are, so they're quite floaty, as it were. They don't want to land, they're not kind of nose back and kind of, you could say, modern style. They're kind of old school style of flying, and they're not doing like sharp sort of turns, you know, in a kind of snappy way, but the routine itself, the way it's written, the way it's flown, is an absolute masterclass in precision. In terms of ballet, yes, you know, you've got Battle Hymn of the Republic, which is also like an old staple, for instance. But then there are other ones to look at, like High Performance, for instance, from 91 in Bristol, which I don't know if there's any video out there that exists, but that's Raiders of the Lost Ark. And that was incredible with stall wraps and landings and so on. And people, and that they were flying North Shore Radicals where everybody else wasn't yet. So they were kind of cutting edge at that point. And then Surfalong Folly in, I think, a year when they flew six with the Blackbirds. I think, oh, we've got a video of that. So I know you've got one on your huge catalog that you're doing with all the competing teams. And I've put it on my playlist on YouTube as well, for team flying. And I was in tears. It still gets me now because the way it's choreographed is so sublime. It's kind of it's perfect. It's not my choice of music, because it's Nicole Kidman and Ewan McGregor singing their duet from Moulin Rouge.
Ooh, that's a good one. Yeah.
But seeing it live was just, I went over to them afterwards and I just said, "You don't know how good this is," because the only time I felt like that, and I'm getting emotional now, is sitting on the sidelines inside the boundary watching High Performance fly their routine in 92 in Odawara in Japan. So being at close quarters, and it was exactly the same feeling. And that gets me, that's the kind of thing where I just go, yeah, I want to do that for the rest of my life, and I want to do it always. If that could be my life, I would be absolutely satisfied. And the choreography is insanely amazing doing that. And then, yeah, and then to kind of, there are other, like Yasu's routines with Overdrive, technically brilliant. And then we've got we respect each other's way of working, but we also see the world differently. So it's really interesting to have these conversations that are very fruitful, you could say. And the Overdrive routine, there's one from 2001 which is brilliant, and it's totally Yasu. He's a double Capricorn, so he's totally kind of, to talk sign language, it's star times, but it's a fixed, rigid grid type of routine, and you can fly it. They practice individually, and then they come together and they put these Lego pieces together to form the routine. And I think the other one, to be kind of, how do I say this without sounding cocky or crass, is the 2014 Scratch Bunnies routine as well, because I dare anybody to try and fly that. It's a hugely technical routine, plus the way that it works with the music. Again, it's our type of music. It's not everybody's type of music, but if you look at the kind of appropriateness of the way the routine works with the music, it's a full entity, plus it's balls to the wall awesome in terms of bravado, its size, its scale, because it's huge as a routine. It goes 4 bars wide, you know, so it's big, and it goes deep. So we had the idea of the 3D in there as well. So Dave is all the way to the far end of the field, and Sash is backing the judges right up into the yellow boundary at the back. That's how sort of we're not standing side by side, we're standing in front of each other and flying over each other. And that's a whole other way of thinking about team flying as a three-dimensional sculpture. And this is where we get into more inspiration, where after that routine and having beers afterwards with Matthew May from Red Bull, and we're the top teams at that competition at that time, and talking about art and talking about this being a sculpture, it's a three-dimensional performance, and the field is a stage and it's a performative space. So we're not thinking about it in getting scoring points. The objective, that's the byproduct. The objective, the real thing is about creating this piece of art, this sculpture that is three-dimensional, these patterns that are more than interesting but captivating, and how that works with music and how you bring people's emotions up and down and, you know, sort of around and about to tell a story, or to take somebody out of where they are and put them in a different sphere, as it were, like, look, you know, like watching opera or ballet or going to a rave or you know, seeing those films where you're completely ensconced and you come out of the film and you'll never be the same again, you know, you can't unsee it, sort of thing. It's those kind of times in your life that those are the inspiring moments. And I think to come back round to sort of the point of this, I think those are for me, those are the kind of key markers, as it were, within sport kiting that for me kind of I'll refer to often, is the kind of, yeah, the top of the line precision, the high performance ballet, the Cervelon Folly ballet, Ninja actually doing precision in Berkeley. And I wonder if you'll have a video of this, because I can't find one.
Berkeley for Ninja? I might. I have a whole bunch of videos I haven't processed yet.
So Ninja, their precision in Berkeley in 93, their Hawaiian kites had 6mm Eastern standoffs. They were built like tanks. They were black and purple. And they did this move that I think they won precision from, right. And they did this kind of sliding diamond thing where they went through each other, and it was this warping, slightly hypnotic, very precise, very sort of fluid movement that never stopped but always changed shape. And I never knew what it was, and I'd love to find out. I'd love to see video to kind of, I've never forgotten that. So yeah, so there's lots of brilliant routines, but I think for me those are the kind of the top of the list.
Okay, I know right now Paul has an interest in oh my God, I'm blanking on the name, out of Japan, and they
Eric.
Like, yeah, Airex, and they like make their own music, because one of them's like, yep, a musician for Disney or something like that.
Yeah.
Which I'm really impressed with, you know, when you can actually make your own music, you know, like, I don't think you guys have this over there, but here in the States, we have big cheerleading competitions and all that. Yeah. And those folks have a musician or a mixer who essentially makes a piece for them that highlights certain movements.
Yeah.
And so it's really cool to see that happening in kites, right? Someone who has just taken the time, and not only when you're writing the routine, you are actually writing the music at the same time.
For the 2014 Scratch Bunnies one, Sash and Chris and James worked on that, and I think they used something like 16 tracks that are all mixed in together and stuff, and there's a few sound effects in there as well, you know. And Dave and James worked on the 2014 one, and I think James and I are working on, we're cooking up something for Pairs at the moment, and we're working, James is doing it on GarageBand. So, nice. Yeah, you know, we used to basically get a cassette tape and, you know, tape to tape and just stop and record, you know, do it that way, do it old school. In Aircraft, we had Paul Fishman, who is a music producer, who saw us fly in Hackney and said, guys, I want to get involved. So he did our music, you know, so he was a proper music producer who did our music. So yeah, it's all self-made, you know, so you find a way, you know, we all know people. The kite world is very eclectic, you know, so you can ask around if you don't know anybody directly. But yeah, I think that, yeah, you've got to know what your intention is with the music before going into it.
Yeah, well, instead of trying to shoehorn everything in, right? Just like,
and there have been those routines where it's just been a load of sound effects and it doesn't work. It's got to be musically, it's got to follow, I was going to say loosely, a narrative, but you know, it has to follow the, I think the music has to stand up on its own by itself. And then also the flying also, in a way, has to stand up by itself. If you can be flying out there, the proof of the pudding is if you're flying the routine with headphones on and people are watching, and they're watching because they can see the patterns happening, they can see the musicality happening, that's always a good sign.
Yeah, I digress. You're not digressing, it's all good. I love it. I absolutely love it.
All right. I hope you enjoyed what you heard during this first part of the interview. Again, over the next few weeks, we're going to be releasing the next few sections of this interview in slightly shorter chunks so that we're not doing these hour-long episodes. And I hope you find something that resonates with you in these interviews. Let me know. Reach out at info@sportkite.org. And yeah, with that, I'm going to go ahead and sign off because it is sunny. It is cold outside, but it is at least sunny and there's a little bit of wind. So I'm going to go ahead and head out and hit the kite field. Hope to see you out there. Bye.